Good morning. You survived the snowpocalypse. It's the first time since I've been here that we've ever canceled church on a Sunday morning, other than planning ahead of time. I think when it fell on Christmas, I think that was one Sunday we didn't have it. We did our best to get the word out, you know, over the app, Facebook, website, all that stuff. But I am curious, did anybody not get the word and show up last week? All right, you guys just missed a golden opportunity to look more spiritual than everyone else. You know, like, I was here, I don't know where all you folks were. All right. I hope you guys had a great week in the snow, stayed safe, had fun with kiddos if you got kids in your life. Today we're going to start a new sermon series on the life of Moses, and we're going to be in Exodus 2. So go ahead and turn your Bibles to Exodus chapter 2. Today's passage is a birth narrative. We're going to look at the birth of Moses. Now, the first five books of the Bible are attributed to Moses, but in the verses we're going to look at today, this is a story that Moses would have been too young to remember. I mean, how many of you remember the day that you were born, right? So what does this tell us? Well, it tells us that Moses was told this story. Moses' parents told him this story because they wanted him to remember it. They wanted him to know where he came from. Brooke and I do the same thing with our kids. We want them to know where they came from. We want them to know their story. And sometimes this story has to do with their birth. And that's the case with our oldest son, Zach. We tell him all the time his birth story. And I've told you his birth story. It's been a couple of years, but I've told it. So you've heard this story before, but you're going to hear it again. Deal with it. Zach was born in 2007, and so being our oldest, his birth was the first time that we'd gone through the whole process. Brooke was induced, so we had an appointment for his birth. At the time, her mom was like the head nurse at the labor and delivery hospital, and so we got special treatment. Some poor lady who had just had a baby got like kicked out of the nicest room in the hospital so that we could have it. And Brooke labored for about 14 hours, and everything was going as planned until it came time for her to push. Now, when you push a baby out, there's a window in the process where the baby's head is positioned in a pelvis in a way where the heartbeat monitors cannot detect vital signs. There's like a danger zone, so to speak. And so doctors are very cautious about how long a baby can remain in this danger zone, because in that window, there's no way for them to know if the baby is in distress. Now, most of the time, the baby's just fine. But if there is a problem, there is no way for the doctor to know. Well, Zach, he was a very big baby, and he had a ginormous head. Like, that was the medical term for it. There was no way he was going to come out. Now, we didn't know this at the time. This was after the fact knowledge, but there was just no way. And so he got stuck in the danger zone, where they couldn't tell if he was okay or in distress. Well, the doctor really wanted Brooke to push Zach out unaided, so she gave her as much time as she could. But the longer Zach stayed in the danger zone, the more uncomfortable the doctor got. Her instructions to Brooke got more urgent. Her eyes got a little bit more determined, and her orders to the nurses got a little bit more curt. Now, I had no idea what was going on, but I could tell that the doctor was uncomfortable. Now, finally, she gave Brooke this last chance call. She said if Zach didn't come out with his last push, they were going to have to help him out. And sure enough, he didn't come out, and they had to help him out. Now, I didn't know what a newborn baby was supposed to look like, but even I could tell that not all was well with Zach. He was blue and lifeless. He wasn't breathing or moving. He had no muscle tone, and his cord was wrapped around his neck. On the Apgar test that they use to measure the health of a baby that's born, he scored a 1 out of 10, 1 being, well, 0 being the lowest, but 1 being low. So the doctor handed me Zach and asked me to cut the umbilical cord, and all I could think of was, like, shouldn't somebody more qualified, you know, be handling this right now? They pulled a code alarm, and all of a sudden, all of these nurses and doctors from all over the facility just flooded into the room. There was a pediatrician who happened to be in the building at the time because she was visiting one of her patients in the middle of the night. And she came in to resuscitate Zach. And we started to pray. We didn't know what was wrong, but we could tell that it wasn't good. And in this moment, all of the silly things that I worry about faded away. And only one thing mattered. We prayed that our son would live. And it's one of those prayers where you think, none of the things that I've ever prayed for in my life mattered. And none of the things that I'm ever going to pray for after this moment will matter. Just answer this one prayer and let my son live. Now, obviously he did. A few moments after he was intubated, Zach began to recover his color. And then he started to move. And then he opened his eyes, and then finally he tried to rip the tube that was helping him breathe out of his mouth, like he wanted out of there right away. I mean, we got a little bit of preview there of what the rest of life with him was going to be like. But he spent a few days in the hospital, and then he came home healthy. Now, so there's times in life when God shows up and makes his presence obvious to you. And this was one of those times for me. I know that God answered my prayers. We had decided on a name for Zachary long before he was born, but his name is an Americanized version of the Hebrew Zechariah, which means the Lord remembers me. And it's often used in the Old Testament in the context of people praying for something for a long time, and then the Lord finally remembering them and answering their prayers. So it fits him. And we tell Zach this story all the time. We tell him on his birthday. We want him to remember. We want him to know that he is an answered prayer. We want that story to shape him. Now today, we're going to look at another origin story, the birth narrative of Moses in Exodus 2, 1 through 10. And I know what you're thinking. What happened to Acts? We were in the middle of the series. We're only in chapter 19. What's the deal? Well, that's a great question, and I'm glad you asked. We are going to come back to Acts later in the year. When we teach through big books of the Bible, we kind of divide them into chunks based on the way the book itself is divided. So like Acts, for instance, has three sections. There's the section at the beginning with the persecuted church in Jerusalem that we called witness. And then it moves on to the church figuring out this question of, like, can Gentiles be saved too? Or is the church only for the Jewish people? We called that series Lord of All. And in the fall, we're going to come back to Acts and we're going to finish it up. But we're stepping away from Acts and we're turning to the life of Moses. Now, if you were going to carve out a Mount Rushmore of Old Testament figures, who would you put on it? You'd obviously put Abraham on there. You'd probably put Jacob on there too. David would be on there. And the fourth person would definitely be Moses. Moses was the great liberator. He led Israel out of slavery to Egypt. He was the great lawgiver. He delivered the Ten Commandments and the instructions of how to build the tabernacle. He was a wonder worker, a military leader, an administrator, a judge, a writer, and a poet. Plus, we can't forget the time when he called his shot during the 1932 World Series. Or the time when he survived the wreck of the Titanic. Or the time when he led the Denver Broncos to a thrilling victory over the Carolina Panthers in Super Bowl 50. All right. Moses was an amazing guy. There's a lot of the Bible is devoted to the life of Moses. But when I was thinking about, like, what set Moses apart from other figures in the Old Testament, the thing that came to mind was Moses' unique relationship to God. Moses and God were friends. And Moses talked to God in ways like nobody else in the Old Testament ever does. You know, Abraham and God, they have a couple conversations, but not very many. Jacob as well, had a couple encounters with God. But Jacob's more of a guy, he's trying to figure out what God is all about. David was passionate for God, but he didn't really talk to God. But Moses and God talk a lot. And Moses talks back to God. I mean, he's like a little sassy at times. God and Moses argue. And yet, listen to what God has to say about Moses. And this is in Numbers chapter 12. God says, if there's a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. But not so with my servant Moses. He's faithful in all my house, and with him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly, and not in riddles, and he beholds the form of the Lord. Now, after Moses dies, the book of Deuteronomy kind of gives this commentary on Moses' life, and it says, and there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. So Moses, he's a liberator, he's a lawgiver, he's a prophet and a commander, but he's also a friend of God, someone that God talked to face to face. And his story begins at the beginning of Exodus, the second book of the Bible. You might remember that our series on Joseph ended at the end of Genesis, the first book of the Bible. Genesis ends with a celebration. God orchestrates this whole thing with Joseph being sold into slavery to Egypt, and then he becomes like second in command over all of Egypt, and then he predicts this famine, and he saves all of Egypt and saves his family, and then he invites his family down to live in Egypt. He forgives his brothers, and the book ends with Israel settling in Egypt, safe and sound and happy, and it's like a celebration. Well, the second book of the Bible, Exodus, begins with some ominous words. Exodus 1:8 says, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So God blessed Israel, and they grew to become extremely numerous. And so this frightened the Egyptians. The Egyptians started to think, you know, if we're ever invaded by a foreign nation, these Israelites might join forces with the invaders, and they might be able to overthrow us. And so they subject the Israelites to slavery. And then Pharaoh, he pronounces this chilling edict, and you might be familiar with it. He pulls aside the Hebrew midwives who are in charge of delivering the babies, and he says to them, if it's a girl, let her live. If it's a boy, throw him in the Nile. And so Pharaoh becomes the first of many evil and powerful people in history who have ordered acts of genocide against the Jewish people. And this is the world that Moses is born into. His people are oppressed. The future is uncertain. God's promises are at risk. And this is what the book of Exodus is about. It's about God liberating his people from slavery, about gathering them together as his chosen people, about making a covenant with them at Sinai. And Moses is going to play a huge role in all of what God does for Israel. But his beginning is humble and perilous. Let's look at starting in verse 1 of Exodus chapter 2. It says, now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. And the woman conceived, and she bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes, and she daubed it with bitumen and pitch. And she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Okay, so the story begins with two people from the tribe of Levi getting married and giving birth to a son. Now, it's going to be important later that Moses' parents are both from the tribe of Levi. That's why that detail's there. Because Moses' brother Aaron is going to become the first high priest, and the tribe of Levi is going to be given charge of the tabernacle and worship duties and stuff like that. So this couple, they start a family before Pharaoh's edict. Okay, and their first kid is a little girl that they name Miriam. And then they have a little boy that they name Aaron. And then when Aaron is about 2 years old, they find out that they're pregnant again. And at first, they celebrate. I mean, like, what could be more exciting about the, you know, the arrival of a new baby? But then comes Pharaoh's edict and the shock. And they have to decide what to do. Remember, this is day, there's no, like, ultrasound or anything like that. There's no way of knowing boy or girl until delivery. And so if it's a girl, no problem. Just, you know, paint the nursery pink and celebrate. But if it's a boy, what do you do? There's an edict. And the punishment for disobedience probably just it isn't just like a fine and some community service. Not when you're a slave, not when the ruler is an autocrat. Pharaoh demanded absolute obedience, and resistance was met with swift punishment, harsh punishment. And so Moses, his parents, they already had two children to worry about. These two little kids needed a mom and a dad. And so for 9 months, they hoped and they prayed for a baby girl. No boy, no problem. Well, then her due date came, and she delivered, and she had a baby boy. Now what? Do they obey the king's edict and throw the baby into the Nile, or do they disobey and put the whole family at risk? Well, this was a test of faith for Moses' parents. God doesn't promise us that if we live for him, that we'll have an easy life. In fact, quite the opposite. It involves hard choices between what we know is right and what would be easier or safer or more popular. And so Moses' parents, they knew that the right thing to do would be to disobey Pharaoh's edict. They knew that. And when they took one look at Moses, they knew that there was no way that they could obey Pharaoh. They needed to do whatever they could to hide this sweet baby boy from Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And so they do. They hide him for 3 months. How did they hide a baby for 3 months? Well, we're not told, but most of the commentaries that I read say that it would be easy to hide a baby for the first 3 months of life because at that age, they just sleep all the time, and if they do cry, you can easily soothe them with nursing. Most of the commentaries I read are written by old men who've obviously not had a baby in their house for quite some time. I don't know how they hid a baby for 3 months. That is a very impressive feat. But they did it. They did it. They kept baby Moses safe for 3 months. But after that, it was just too difficult. I mean, as babies get older, just more awake, louder, more active, more demanding, tougher to conceal. And it's just going to get worse. As the baby gets older, it's just going to get worse. And so Moses' parents, they wanted what was best for him. They wanted what was best for the family. And so they knew they couldn't hide Moses forever. He was going to be discovered, and the family was going to pay the price. So they knew that baby Moses needed a new home. He needed a new start. He needed a new story to his life because the story that he was born into didn't end well. And so they came up with a plan. Moses' mom, she makes this ark out of reeds. It's actually the same word to use to describe what Noah built in Genesis 6, only smaller, we assume. She puts the little baby into the boat, and then she places it in the reeds. And then it says, you know, they're not quite sure what's going to happen to this baby, but they're not afraid, right? They're confident that God is going to rescue the baby in some way because of the way that verse 4 is worded. Verse 4 says that his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. So you get to the impression that they knew that God was going to do something for this baby. They just weren't quite sure what that something was going to be. Let's look at verse 5. It says, now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and while her young women walked beside the river, she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying. And she took pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Right, so the story shifts from the perspective of Moses' parents to now of Pharaoh's daughter. She goes down to the river to bathe, and she sees this basket in the reeds, and she doesn't think much of it until she hears a sound. It's the sound of a baby crying. And so she sends one of her servant girls to go check out what's in this basket and bring the basket over. And Pharaoh's daughter looks into it, and she says, this is one of the Hebrews' babies. Now, many of you know this story, and you kind of know how it ends, how it's going to turn out. But imagine if you didn't. Imagine if you didn't know that. This is an intense moment. This is Pharaoh's daughter. She lives in Pharaoh's palace. Her dad is the one who made this edict about throwing babies into the Nile. How would she respond to finding one of their babies in a basket in the river? Well, the natural reaction for her would be just to dump it into the river, right? I mean, that was what the law said to do, and her dad was the one who made the law. Disobeying it probably would bring severe consequences on her. And so, like, of all the people in Egypt who could have discovered Moses, why did it have to be her? I mean, couldn't God have directed that basket to somebody else who maybe would be a little bit more sympathetic to the Hebrews' plight? So what's this girl going to do? Verse 7. So then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to come nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and she nursed him. And when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, saying, "Because," she said, "I drew him out of the water." So Miriam, Moses' sister, she's hiding in the reeds, and she's watching to see what's going to happen to this baby. And she sees Pharaoh's daughter pull the baby out of the basket, and she recognizes it as a Hebrew baby. And even though Miriam, she's just a little girl at this point, even she recognizes that this is a crucial moment. That this is a moment of life or death. She can kind of see the wheels turning Pharaoh's daughter's mind. What do I do with this baby? So she jumps out and she says to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go call a nurse from one of the Hebrew women who can take care of this baby for you?" And there's this long, awkward silence as everyone present waits to hear the princess's verdict and the fate of this baby. And finally, she says, "Go." And Moses is saved. And so Miriam goes and she gets her mom and she says to her, "Hey, Pharaoh's daughter needs to see you. She found our baby." And so imagine what this meeting must have been like for Moses' mom. Okay, she probably arrives sheepishly at the river to talk to Pharaoh's daughter about the discovery. And you know, she doesn't have any rights, right? She's a slave, and she's talking to royalty here. And further compounding things, she has to pretend like this is not her baby. She has no idea what's going on, and she has no interest in the baby's fate or the whole thing. And so she sees this girl, the daughter of the man who has just pronounced this edict to destroy her people, and she's holding her baby, and she has to pretend like she doesn't know what's going on, while the whole time her gaze is just locked on this young girl's grip on her baby, and she's thinking, "If you hurt that little boy, I will throw you down like a poodle body slamming a cat." And then she says, "You called for me, Prince? But you've never seen a poodle body slam a cat?" See it again. That is amazing. This is the best thing on the internet right now, I tell you what. Okay. There you go. Now you've seen a poodle body slam a cat. All right. So Moses' mom, she has to pretend like she doesn't know what's going on. She's like, "Oh, you found this baby. You called for me, princess?" And Pharaoh's daughter is like, "Yes, are you one of the Hebrew nurses?" And Moses' mom is thinking, "No, but I can nurse that baby for you." And right? And she says, "Yes, this little girl tells me that you have a baby that's in need of a nurse." And the princess says, "Yes, I found a baby. It's a little Hebrew baby, and I want you to nurse him, and I'll pay you your wages. And when he's weaned, I want you to return him to me." So Moses' mom, she gets her baby back, and she gets to raise him. A little different in that culture. She probably got him for 5 to 7 years before she turned him over to Pharaoh's daughter. And she got paid for it. And she didn't have to be afraid about what Moses' future would look like. And the point of the story is clear. God was watching over Moses. I mean, the story, otherwise it's just too unbelievable. There's too many coincidences. I mean, and consider how this story would have affected Moses for the rest of his life. Because Moses probably heard this story many times. Every year on his birthday, his mother probably gathered the family around and said, "Hey, let's remember what happened to Moses the day that he was born. Moses, when you were born, we didn't know how you were going to make it. At that time, we were supposed to throw baby boys like you into the Nile, but we knew we could never do that to you, and so we hid you. We hid you for 3 whole months. There were some close calls, but God protected you. Now, after 3 months, you were just getting too big. There were too many close calls, and we were worried that you would be found. We couldn't hide you forever. So we put you in a basket in the river, and we prayed for God to protect you, and I knew he would save you. I knew he would save you. Because God, we can always trust God, even when we have to do something hard. He's always trustworthy." And then even when Moses went on to live with Pharaoh's daughter, he probably heard this same story, a different variation of it. Pharaoh's daughter is the one that actually gives Moses his name. She names him Moses. Moses is actually an Egyptian name, not a Hebrew name. But it sounds like the Hebrew word mashah, which means to draw out. She's still called Moses because I drew him out of the water. And so even after he left his mother to go live with Pharaoh's daughter, he probably was reminded of his birth story. On his new birthday, the anniversary of the day when Pharaoh's daughter found him, she would say, "Moses, let me tell you the story of how you joined our family. One day, I was going down to the river just like every other day when suddenly I heard a sound. And it was a sound like a baby crying, and I thought, who would leave a baby down here by the river all by itself? And just then, I noticed a basket. And I sent someone to get it, and we looked inside, there you were." And hearing that story would remind Moses of the other side of the story. The part his birth mother told him, the part about putting him in the basket and trusting God to take care of him, the part about God being trustworthy, the part about God being with us when we have to do hard things. And this story would come back to Moses, because Moses, when he got older, he had to trust God when he did hard things. When he returned to Egypt as an old man to confront Pharaoh, kind of remembered what his mom told him. God is with us. We can trust him when we have to do hard things. When Moses and the people stood on the banks of the Red Sea, Pharaoh's army behind them, God is with us. We can trust him when we have to do hard things. When they're in the wilderness and they don't have any food or any water, God is with us. Can trust him when we have to do hard things. When they send spies off to Canaan and they come back and they're like, "I know God told us that this is our land, but there's giants in that land." God is with us. We can trust him when we have to do hard things. Now, as we follow the life of Moses, we are going to celebrate God's redeeming acts. I mean, after all, God is the main character here, not Moses. But we're also going to commend Moses for his faith, because he's a model for us. But the story of Moses' faith doesn't start with Moses. It starts with his mother, a woman who wasn't afraid of Pharaoh's edict, a woman confident that God was with her and that she could trust him when she had to do hard things, and a woman who taught her son to believe those things too. Now, in a moment, we're going to respond to the gospel. The band's going to come back up. We've got a couple more songs to sing. While we sing, we're also going to celebrate the Lord's Supper. So know, if this is your first time here, know that you are free to come forward, but you don't have to. If that's uncomfortable for you, you can remain where you are. Just know that you might have to let other people in your row get by. While we sing, I'd also love to pray for you. I'll be standing right back there. Johnny is going to be back there. He'd love to pray for you too. So if there's something going on, big or small, we'd love to pray for you. But before we respond, There is one more thing that I want us to look at. There's a couple people in the Old Testament who are supposed to remind us of Jesus. You know, David reminds us of the royalty of Jesus. Jesus is a king like David. Elijah reminds us of the prophetic ministry of Jesus. Jesus did extraordinary acts like Elijah did. But of all the people in the Old Testament that Jesus kind of compares himself to, well, the one that points us the most to Jesus is Moses. Jesus consistently modeled his ministry after Moses. In Jesus' most famous sermon, he says, "You've heard it said," and he quotes Moses. And then he says, "But I say," and he gives us a new commandment. He portrays himself as a lawgiver like Moses. He talks about how Moses gave the people bread from heaven. But then Jesus says that he himself is the bread of life. Just like Moses led captives out of Egypt, so also Jesus liberates us from bondage to sin. Now, the account of Moses' birth also parallels that of Jesus. In his commentary on the book of Exodus, Brevard Childs notes the similarities. He says, both Jesus and Moses were born during the reign of a tyrant. Both came at a time when Israel was in distress. Both Jesus and Moses' very existence was at risk when the king tried to kill him. Both were rescued just in the nick of time. Both had to flee their birthplace and then return to it later. The birth of Moses signifies a turning point in the history of Israel. I mentioned at the beginning of this message that my son Zachary's name is an Americanized version of the Hebrew Zechariah, which means "the Lord remembers me." And I told you it was used in the context of God's hearing people's prayers after them crying out for a long time and said God remembered them and he acted. Well, one of the places where it's used like this is in Exodus chapter 2. If you skip down to verse 23, it says, "During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery, and they cried out for help. And their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." Moses' birth signified a turning point in the history of Israel. It signified God remembering them. And in the same way, Jesus' birth, life, and death signified a turning point. Jesus' birth is retold in the Gospels as an intentional callback to the birth of Moses. Jesus is born to a people enslaved, not enslaved to a nation, but enslaved to sin. And his birth signified the beginning of a rescue movement. And so as we take the bread and the cup, I want us to consider that. The Lord remembers you. Some of you feel trapped. You're caught in a cycle of sin and guilt and pain, and you don't know if you'll ever be liberated. The cross reminds us that the Lord remembers you. He sees your pain. He's making all things new. Some of you have been hurt. You've been mistreated, abused, and you wonder if God cares. Well, the cross is the place where God suffers abuse. He takes our pain and our shame in order to put the world to rights and put an end to sin and injustice. The cross reminds us that the Lord remembers us. And some of you, like the Israelites in Exodus, are crying out to God for deliverance. And maybe you, like Moses' mom, entrusted a loved one to God, but your loved one wasn't saved. You know, Moses wasn't the only baby boy born in Egypt at that time. And not all of those babies' mothers' prayers were answered in the same way that Moses' mom was. Maybe you wonder if God has forgotten you. Well, the cross reminds us that he hasn't. That death does not have the final word. That the cross always leads to resurrection. The Lord remembers us. Will you stand with me while we prepare for the Lord's Supper? The Apostle Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 11, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it, and he said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, also, he took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" Let's pray. Father, we confess that you're with us. You're with us right now. You'll be with us tomorrow. You'll be with us next week. And Father, my heart goes out right now to those who can't sense that you're with them, who feel like you're not. I pray that this act of remembering Jesus would just remind them that they're not alone, that they have a God who loves them. They have a God who died for their sins to reconcile them to himself, that they have a family, a body of followers of Jesus who love them as well. We thank you for being with us, and we remember Jesus right now in his faithfulness and going to the cross. And it's in his name we pray. Amen.